Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up on the show today, a topic that has always divided not only individuals in Washington State, but also the Seattle media, is the topic of policing. There was a story that came out that is not too great for the Seattle Police Department. We'll discuss the ins and outs of it, but it's also exposing a continuing rift in the media in the way that issues around policing are covered. Also, Attorney General Bob Ferguson on his campaign website is touting his record on protecting communities from sexually violent predators. But is he telling the whole truth? Is he telling the whole story? We'll dive into it. Also, Governor Jay Inslee says he wants more money, not wants, needs more money to help with his program that removes homeless encampments from state right-of-ways. But I have approximately 143 million reasons as to why he shouldn't get another dime. Later on, and this is a good one, later on, our friends over at Future 42 are giving you an opportunity tomorrow to pay the national average for a gallon of gasoline. We're going to tell you where you can get it, an opportunity to save money, but also an opportunity for folks to get a dose of truth in the process. All of that and more coming up. But first, if you've not become a subscriber, please support our show. We are growing a mission and a movement to try to not tip the scales in Washington State, but to right the scales when it comes to media coverage of politics, media coverage of politicians. And your $5 by becoming an Undivided subscriber helps us to do that. UndividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com. All right, it's no secret I'm pro-law enforcement. I'm pro-good law enforcement, which I think most reasonable, rational people should be. I think police officers in this state in particular have dealt with a lot of crap that they did not deserve. Some of it, you know, the result of legitimate errors in judgment by police officers, but some of it completely manufactured political outrage from leftists. So anyway, whenever a story comes out about alleged misconduct from a police officer, I always want to look at it through the lens of, okay, try to give them the benefit of the doubt in situations, especially where split-second decisions have to be made, but also understand that police officers are the most powerful people among us. They have a badge and a gun, and they have the ability to take someone's life away. They have the ability to enforce our laws, and they have the ability to take someone's freedom away, albeit temporarily. And so I always want to keep that in mind when I'm talking about stories involving police conduct. And I'll say, I can't imagine the Seattle Police Department is too pleased at these headlines in this video this morning, but a little context before I get into the video that's all over local media in Seattle today. So you'll probably recall back in January of this year, there was a 23-year-old Northeastern college student who was walking across a crosswalk in the Southlake Union neighborhood of Seattle, Janavi Kandula, again, just 23 years old, and she was hit and killed by a Seattle police cruiser. An officer was on his way to a call of an overdose, so he was driving pretty fast, lights and sirens, when he struck this 23-year-old and she died from her injuries. And that's horrifying. I mean, horrific. It was covered pretty extensively in the news at the time, and there's ongoing investigations into the actual crash itself. So I had heard rumblings starting not too long ago that there was a pretty unfortunate dash cam in-car video pertaining to this case, and that it had to do with what is a fellow police officer, but a drug recognition expert. So the officer had been called to the scene to do, it's called a DRE, basically to make sure that the officer involved wasn't impaired, which he found that he was not impaired. He had just been going to this emergency call. But that drug recognition expert also happens to be the vice president of the Seattle Police Union. And so for some reason, his body camera video, I think that's what it was. Yeah, it wasn't dash cam, it was body camera. His body-worn camera was rolling while he was in his car during a union phone call. So there's really no reason he should have had his body cam video on. I imagine he now wishes that it had not been on. But he was on and recorded part of a phone call that he had after responding to this scene with the president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, Mike Solon. So you're going to hear Officer Daniel Arderer. You're going to hear his end of the phone call, and it's just a 2-minute or so clip, so we're going to play the whole thing that was released by the Seattle Police Department. You're not able to hear what Mike Solon is saying on this other side, but that is who he's on the phone with. So let's watch the video in full.
Yep. Yep, totally. All right, brother. Well, I'm sure TCIS is. And I... Oh, he's good. He says, well, normally we don't give voluntary statements. And I said, hey, you're going to have to decide if you wanted to give a statement or not. But it does not seem like there's a criminal investigation going on. Otherwise, there would be other... What's that? Yeah. Otherwise, there might be other people arriving, correct? Yeah, I mean, he's going 50. That's not out of control. That's not reckless for a trained driver. Yeah, lights and sirens. Yeah. Yeah, well, there's some... Initially, he said she was in a crosswalk. There's a witness that says, no, she wasn't. But that witness could be different because I don't think she was thrown 40 feet either. I think she went up on the hood, hit the windshield, then when he hit the brakes, flew off the car. But she is dead. No, it's a regular person. Yeah. Yeah, just write a check. Just... Yeah, what? $11,000. She was 26 anyway. She had limited value.
A few things. I mean, you could watch that and first of all, the laughing is completely inappropriate. I don't care what context it is. We're going to discuss the context of that conversation. You're having a conversation about a 23-year-old who's dead. The laughing is completely inappropriate. But essentially, there has been some really divergent coverage of that particular video. And also, there's now kind of some simultaneous investigations into it. So, a few days ago, our friend Jason Rantz over at KTDH, who's a conservative radio host, a very pro-law enforcement, he had done a story without the video from the perspective really of that officer, Officer Daniel Arterer, and he was citing a complaint that officer filed against himself. So what Jason Rantz said in his reporting is this officer realized, and you saw at the end of the video, he's sort of like, oh God, is this thing on? He's like trying to turn it off. Realized that, hey, if that were to be heard, it would not be good. And so he reported himself to the Office of Professional Conduct, Accountability. And so Jason's reporting is based on that officer's version of events per the report he filed on himself for them to look into. And what that officer claimed is that he and Mike Solon, during that last part of the conversation, were mocking city attorneys who they would believe that the value of this 23-year-old was, you know, $11,000 or something. Oh, she's only 23. And that's where the laughing and the snickering is. And they were mocking, like, sort of the callousness of city attorneys or the city that would try to get out of paying this young girl's family. That's his version of events. Now, having read Jason's story a few days ago and now seeing the video, I'm not sure whether I believe that or not. But when you compare it to the Seattle Times coverage of it, the Seattle Times coverage, the headline, investigation launched into tape of Seattle Police Guild leaders downplaying death of a woman struck by officers. Mike Carter writes, a Seattle Police Watchdog Agency is investigating rank-and-file union leaders over body camera audio in which they laugh and joke about and downplay the death of a young woman struck by a police cruiser, suggesting her life had limited value and the city should just write a check. So he's clearly approaching it from the side of, they absolutely were laughing, downplaying her death, and they are the ones who think that her life isn't worth something and the city should just write a check. Now, I would argue that neither real versions of the coverage of that story are reflective of what we know about, what we know to be true. You know, and in our friend Jason's coverage, you know, talking about the missing context, how the officer believed, according to the OPA report, that this video would be taken out of context. The problem is, I don't know whether we're taking the video out of context or not, because I cannot hear the other side of that conversation. It's not audible in the clip. Specifically, I want to know what Mike Solon said when this officer started to laugh. I want to know what Mike Solon said when this officer said, no, it's a regular person. I'm assuming it was something like, oh, was it a homeless junkie or something like that? And I want to know what Mike Solon said on the other end of the conversation when this officer responded by saying, oh, you know, they could just write a check. Her life had limited value. She was only 23 years old. And so I really think that this gets into really the division in the media when it comes to the coverage of police issues. Is you really do have, and I'm not trying to, you know, I love our friend Jason Rantz, and I think he's very pro-police, and usually his reporting and perspective on those issues is spot on, but I think it's a little unfair to say at this point that the video is taken out of context, because unless Mike Solon comes forward on the record in some sort of official interview and says, here's exactly what I said and what his reaction was, and we can match those things up, then what do we know? I don't know if it's taken out of context or not. So I'm not going to take the officer's word, who is, of course, going to spin it in the best possible light for the circumstances. And as far as Mike Carter over the Times, who is notably anti-police, for him to, again, lacking the context of what was happening on the other end of that phone, for him to suggest that they were joking and downplaying the death of a young woman and claiming that her life had limited value, he also doesn't know. He also doesn't know the context of the conversation. And this is when we spiral into this real divisiveness in these camps when it comes to policing. And I had a chat with Nicole before the story today, or before we put this on our show sheet today. And I was like, you know, one of my kind of commitments to covering police issues in a way that I hope makes it less divisive and doesn't contribute to the vitriol as quickly is I'm going to be pro-police. And that's the standard that I approach issues with. And if there is evidence that an officer, hold on, I have to have a drink or something. Sorry, Nicole. In my throat today.
No problem.
If I have evidence that something's egregious, like it's right in front of your face, and you're like, that's ridiculous, I'm going to be the first person to come out and to say so. And the reason is because I want to make sure that when I am rightfully defending police conduct, when I am rightfully urging people to wait for facts, that that rings true and that rings intellectually honest, because when there are obvious egregious instances where an officer has done something wrong, I'm readily willing to call it out. And I think that's the best approach to police stories, is recognizing they have a tremendous amount of power. So yeah, when they do something clearly, blatantly wrong, you got to call it out, because you'd call it out with, if you're a good, solid journalist, with any other person in a position of authority who does something wrong, like a politician. And then when there are instances where, hey, we got to wait for the facts, or hey, that is not fair, that's, you're twisting what happened, you're twisting his words, then I think people are more likely on both sides to listen to what you have to say. So anyway, I want to know more about this. I will say, just personally, if I take my journalist cap off, the video doesn't strike me very well. Not at all. The laughter, the sort of dismissiveness, I don't care if you shouldn't have been recording at the time, obviously you were. So that strikes me as very callous. And I'm thinking of, if that was a 23-year-old sibling of mine or relative of mine, how I would feel if I heard that. However, I am open to the excuse the officer gave of they were mocking attorneys who might be, you know, just waiting in the wings to try to get money out of this. But I have a hard time seeing that fit into what I heard and the laughter and, oh, is that a real person or was it regular or real? Is that a regular person? Because even if it's a homeless individual or someone using drugs, if they're in a crosswalk or whatever it is, like, that shouldn't factor into whether they should have or whether the officer's actions were appropriate. So again, it's just getting into these camps where it's like, if I like police, they can do no wrong. If I hate police, like, every single one of them are evil, even if they didn't do anything wrong at all. And that just can't be where we're at. That can't be the position that we operate in. I will read for you just the Seattle Police Department statement on it. It was, I'm not going to read all of it because it was sort of in and out, but they said that this video came to them In the routine course of business by a department employee who saw it, was concerned about the nature of the statements heard. And so that's how it got to the command staff, at least, and referred to OPA for investigation. They end the statement by saying SPD has been in touch with the family of the victim and continues to honor their expressed request for privacy as others in the accountability system proceed with their work. We again extend our deepest sympathy for this tragic collision. And it is a tragedy. It's heartbreaking. And no matter what the intent of that officer was in that conversation, I imagine that the result is probably very difficult for the family to hear that, knowing that just, you know, a couple hours earlier, their loved one had been struck, would ultimately die from her injuries. So it's sad all around. And because of that, you know, we need to be really careful in sort of how we cover these things. And, you know, at the times, I think that a lot of their stories tend to assign the worst possible intentions to every single officer, which is obviously wrong, but I think it's also dangerous to assign the best intentions, because then people kind of tune you out. So we will track that one, but definitely an unfortunate story for the Seattle Police Department and a fortunate headline. Okay, I was going to end the show with this story on Bob Ferguson yesterday for a sanity check, but I thought, well, we were running a little long yesterday, and I was like, also, I need to look into this more in terms of where is this coming from? So you know that political candidates, politicians, but we're talking about political candidates in this context, they'll use like one little thing they said or did, and they'll turn it into something completely different as a way to, oh, tout their record on this and this. And it's like, okay, that was one thing you did 8 years ago, but what have you done since? And I believe this is an unfortunate example of Bob Ferguson doing this on his campaign site. So on his campaign site, he's talking about all the things he's done and why he should be governor. And one of the things he says on his site is that he's standing up for survivors of violent crime. Okay. Well, let's see what he said. Well, I won't dismiss him too quick, but let's see what he said. Bob kept nearly 100 of the most violent sex predators out of our communities. He's using innovative new tools to help law enforcement solve cold case homicides and sexual assaults. He wrote and passed bipartisan legislation to make our courthouses safer. He increased protections for survivors of human trafficking. He's working to end Washington's shameful backlog of rape kits because Bob believes these victims of sexual assault deserve justice. Okay. So there are a few things in there that really stood out to me where I was like, that's news to me. One of them is he increased protections for survivors of human trafficking. And look, I'm not saying that when it comes to people who've survived human trafficking that his office hasn't done anything to help them on the back end. However, as I pointed out on the show now, I think it was like 2 weeks ago, Bob Ferguson still hasn't used an ounce of his political influence to speak out about lax security at the southern border. A lot of people who are being human trafficked eventually on our streets are trafficked here from other countries up through the southern border. And so you can help them after they've already been victimized and their lives have potentially been ruined, or you can try to prevent them from being victimized in the first place. And so I think it's his words versus his actions. And sometimes you say, oh, actions are more important. But sometimes when you're in a position like his, words are just as important. What he says, what he uses his influence to say, to advocate for. And in this case, I believe really he should be advocating for security at the southern border. I think that's just as important for someone like him. The other part of that that just hit me right over the head was when he said Bob kept nearly 100 of the most violent sex predators out of our communities. Okay. So we spent like the first 6 months of this year covering this issue with sexually violent predators. So in Washington State, in case you're not familiar, we have something called SVPs, where if you commit a sex crime, if you're the worst of the worst, like you're deemed irredeemable, after your prison sentence, you could be sent to an island and be civilly committed there unless you're able to successfully petition for your release. I love that. Because I think a lot of these sex predators are very likely to reoffend. So I like the law that Washington has that allows for a process for civil commitment to a freaking island. I think that's great. But, so the Attorney General's office is responsible for the legal ins and outs of that process, of someone being determined to be a SVP, a sexually violent predator, and the advocating for or against someone's release from the island. If you have someone who says, hey, I think that I'm rehabilitated and I want to petition the court and go through the process to try to end the civil commitment, get off the island and go back into a community setting. And so if the attorney general's office is like, no, you need to stay on the island, it would be the attorney general's office, an attorney from that office, who would represent the state in pushing back against that. So when Bob says, Bob kept nearly 100 of the most violent sex predators out of our communities, what strikes me about that first is that that's part of your responsibilities. That's just baseline stuff. It's the job of the office of the attorney general and a unit in that office to deal with these cases because of the way our law works with sexually violent predators. So you're celebrating something that is just the job of your office, in course. But I looked, and I will give them some credit, they have fought on multiple occasions while he's been attorney general to stop the release of SVPs, certain SVPs, from the island. We dug up, just to name a couple, a press release in 2016, AG trial win keeps Island County sex offender confined on McNeil Island. Let's see, there was one from 2015 where the Attorney General's office had a SVP bill to stop sort of some loopholes. It said, Attorney General Bob Ferguson's proposal to close a loophole in the sexually violent predator statute to prevent the release of offenders who have not been rehabilitated passed the state Senate yesterday, 46-0. So yeah, I mean, this is like 8 years ago, but sure. There was a story, and there have been, by the way, some reviews that have been done where the Attorney General's office did not fight to keep someone on McNeil Island. This was just one example we found. Washington's first female sexually violent predator released to Spokane. The Attorney General's office basically determined that they didn't meet the criteria to continue to commit her there. So yeah, I mean, if we're just looking at the facts of what his office has and has not done, there have been instances where they fought to keep these sexually violent predators on McNeil Island who want to get off, and there have been times where they haven't fought to keep them there. But here's the thing where I go into words versus actions. Okay, those are some things that your office did going back 8 years ago, but when communities like Enumclaw and Tenino and parents in those communities, when you had sexually violent predators who were going to be released into less secure placements, close to school bus stops in their communities, when you had them in the fight of their lives for the first 6 months of the year to stop that from happening, to get state lawmakers to pass common sense legislation, you had parents going to Olympia, meeting with state lawmakers, you had parents emailing the Office of Attorney General Bob Ferguson, pleading with them, please help us stop these placements. Please at least pass a common sense law to give our communities more notification before sexually violent predators are placed here. Do you think that Bob Ferguson's office met with those communities and those parents? No. Do you think that Bob Ferguson's office advocated for common sense bipartisan bills to be pushed through and passed by the end of the legislative session that would put a pause on those releases, that would require, oh gosh, more community notification before those placements? No. Those parents were in the fight of their life. And if Bob Ferguson really cared about protecting communities from sexually violent predators, he would have been standing right there alongside them. He would have had a press conference on the steps of the state capitol with those parents from Enumclaw and Tenino saying, this isn't right. I don't stand for this. We need to make sure at the very least communities are notified so they can protect their families, so they can know who's moving in down the street. So Bob Ferguson, again, he can tout cases and press releases from 8 years ago as a way to say on his website, he's standing up for survivors of violent crime. But in the past 5, 6 years, when we've had some insane examples of the erosion of public safety, of violent crime being allowed to fester to the point where it's now at crisis levels, where has Bob Ferguson been? He hasn't used his words, his political influence, to try to make things better. He has stood idly by, watched them get worse, and now he wants to be the governor. So you can say all you want and point to little individual things over your long tenure in the Attorney General's office and say you've been standing up for survivors of violent crime. But holistically, I don't buy it. Holistically, you have let communities flail as they are dealing with severe issues related to public safety. I've gone through a lot of them on the show over the last 2 weeks, but you know, I talked about the his lack of care or concern for the erosion of our state's felony drug possession statute. I've talked about his complete silence when lawmakers made it nearly impossible for police to pull over criminals or to pursue criminals if they pull off from a traffic stop. So come on, Bob. And this is the thing, is like politicians and political candidates, they'll say anything. If there's a grain of truth to it, if they can spin it and still maintain a little grain of truth, they'll blast that. You'll see it political advertisements. You'll see it on their campaign website. And they're just hoping and counting on people not looking into it further. It's called gaslighting. In this case, I wouldn't call it flat out lying because he can point to a couple examples. But it is not giving a complete picture of who he has been as a politician and who he has been as the state's chief enforcer of the laws. So just something to ponder. All right. Coming up next, Governor Jay Inslee says that he needs one thing in order to remove more homeless encampments from state right-of-ways. He needs more money. I'm going to explain to you by the numbers why we shouldn't be giving Governor Jay Inslee another dime to carry out that program. We'll talk about that next. But first, I'm going to talk about our friends at Firstmark Insurance, firstmarkinsurance.com. Everyone needs insurance. We sure hope that you'll give Firstmark Insurance a chance and take the Firstmark Challenge. It's something Mike and I did in the spring. We're very happy we did. We've heard from so many of you who have done the same. And what they'll do is they'll go through all your current insurance. They'll talk to you about your insurance needs, help you understand what all the crazy numbers and coverage mean. They'll go out for free, they'll shop the market for you, and they'll come back to you with a recommendation. Dave Taylor is the CEO of Firstmark. He talked a little bit about the purpose of the Firstmark Challenge.
We believe and we say that we will help 100% of the people that we work with. Okay. Now that doesn't mean necessarily that 100% of the people we work with are going to become Firstmark clients, but we believe that we will actually help 100% of the people, whether that be stay with your current carrier, but let's modify your coverage a bit so you're better protected, or ultimately, hopefully come over to Firstmark. We're going to put you with a different company and give you better coverage, right? So the challenge is really challenging individuals to give us an opportunity to prove that to them. That's really what the Firstmark Challenge is.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things, and I think the really cool things about Firstmark, and it says a lot about them as a company, is I've had several of you now say, hey, I took the Firstmark Challenge. They came back to me and said, actually, you should keep your current insurance because it's pretty good and you're getting a good value for it. So that tells me that they are in it for you. And that's why they're saying is Firstmark, they work for you because they truly do. So give them a chance. And it's also a good opportunity to support a sponsor of our show, firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. They work for you. All right, Governor Jay Inslee says they need more money to carry out his program that removes homeless encampments from state rights of way. Let's talk about all the reasons why he actually doesn't need any more money. Let's get to it in our segment, Unbelievable. Okay, as you know, Governor Jay Inslee has been criticized pretty roundly for allowing some of these homeless encampments along state highways, as an example, to just absolutely proliferate and grow. And it became, I mean, really incredibly dangerous. We talked about the one where that by Harborview Medical Center, where the whole freaking thing went up in flames because of some drug turf war, hospital nearby, right by I-5 in downtown Seattle. I mean, you remember all those headlines of people, homeless individuals throwing rocks and debris off of the interchange there by I-90 and I-5, hitting people's cars, could have killed people. I mean, that was all happening because the state had allowed these WashDOT properties to be overrun by homeless encampments, and they weren't doing a dang thing about it. So anyway, more recently, the governor has been touting his right-of-way program, talking about the state going around and, you know, finally clearing out some of these encampments. But he was at a camp, and Como News spoke to him. Paul Riviera, is that his name? I like Paul. And asked him about, you know, sort of continuing this program and you know, whether the program was successful and can they do more with it. Listen for a second to the unbelievable governor of ours.
We will need the legislature in January to appropriate more funding because we're out of funding for the right-of-way initiative right now. So we'll need the legislature in January to step up to increase funding so we can continue the progress we're making.
You're funded to January, right? After January, if you don't get funding from the legislature, do these camps just stay in these locations?
We will need more funding to continue this right-of-way initiative. We essentially are out, we run our string out for the ones that we have planned right now. To add to that, we will need additional funding in the legislature. But I believe that...
So you don't get funding, they're just going to have to stay there.
That's correct. You can't do this with $0.
You can't do this with $0. First of all, the state has the most bloated budget. And that's a whole different conversation to this one. I mean, the state needs someone to come in there and absolutely take the pen to the budget. Because when you say, oh, we have $0, it makes me actually sick how much money you take from people. The amount of tax revenue that you're getting in, not to mention the tax, the money that you're getting in from the new carbon program. I mean, we can go on and on and on. The state is not hurting for money. The state can accomplish everything it needs to accomplish and more with the money it already has. However, let's pretend for a second. I'm going to hit you with some really unfortunate data. But let's pretend for a second that this program had been really, really successful. It was making a huge impact in our homelessness crisis. And they were spending, you know, all the money to really good effect. We were getting people out of homelessness. You know, I might feel differently about the governor saying, hey, this thing is moving and grooving. We need more cash. And I think Republicans and Democrats alike would be like, you got it. However, that's really not the case. So I want to go through some of the numbers here in what they're spending and what the outcomes are from that spending. All right. So I'm going to show you, if you're watching the stream, kind of an involved graphic, but I put some red boxes around the things that really need your attention. So far, and this is a handy little, I'm glad they do this, the Washington State Department of Commerce, they've got a little ticker that's got the money spent and then the outcomes. Okay, what happened to the people that we cleared from these encampments? Love that. Transparency. Although this is a case where transparency makes them look awful bad. but we appreciate it. So far, they have spent $143 million. $143 million on this right-of-way encampment program, right? So the number of homeless individuals who have been cleared from encampments on state property with that $143 million is 1,299. Of the 1,299, 870 accepted housing, some sort of housing. It could have been temporary shelter or permanent supportive housing. And of those, so of all the people who have been removed from homeless encampments on state right-of-ways, with $143 million in spending, 126 of them have had successful exits from the system. And I take that to mean essentially they're not homeless anymore. 126, okay? If you think that doesn't sound like very much, you're right. And depending on what you view as a success, I'm going to go through a couple different numbers with you. And you tell me if any of these dollar figures sound like success to you, sound like a good use of taxpayer funds, sound like a program that is worthy of us dumping more of our hard-earned money into, okay? So I'm giving you three figures here because I think it's fair that different people might see different, might have different definitions of what success for this program means. Okay, Nicole, do you want to pull that up? So if you think success is they got homeless people out of the state right away, like that's success to you, is I no longer have to look at that homeless encampment along the highway. Okay, so we divided 143 million by the number of people who were actually removed from encampments, regardless of where they went on to go, whatever it is. If you think success is you went in there and swept them out, then the state spent $110,000 per person, essentially. So if that's success to you, they swept out people, 1,299 people, then it cost about $110,000 per homeless person to move them out of that state right away. Now, let's say you think that, well, that's not really success because they could have just gone somewhere else. So let's say that you think success is a person who is living in a state right away now has some sort of housing, now is in shelter or supportive housing, and you say that would be success to me. Okay, so if you look at it that way, and again, you had 870 people accept an offer of housing from what the state cleared, then you'd be looking at about $164,000 per person. That would be the breakdown of the cost associated with moving people from the state right-of-way into some sort of housing. Now, let's say that your version of success is more strict than that. That your version of whether this is a successful program is whether that person removed from a state right-of-way is no longer homeless anymore. If that's your version of success, then we would have to account for the cost associated with getting 126 people out of the system. So at a total spend of $143 million, to get 126 people out of the system, meaning no longer homeless, the cost per person is $1,137,256. Now, I would argue that not one of those figures represents a good use of your money. Not one of those figures seems to be even in line with the reality of what it would cost if you had private enterprise who was dealing with this, if you had the private sector dealing with this. This is government incompetence. This is government waste. And it's all the result of political cowardice. Remember, we're talking about money being spent to fix a crisis that never should have been allowed to get this bad. Because really, it's a result of the drug crisis, and it's a result of the mental health crisis. So we shouldn't even be in a position where we're having to allocate $143 million, plus now the governor wants more, $143 million to clear camps that have gotten so bad that they present a danger to the public. Camps along state right-of-ways or on state property never should be here. We shouldn't even have to talk about this money being spent. But okay, here we are. What are we going to do now? I can't go back and unring a bell. I can't go back 10 years and wish we had politicians with a spine who were honest. So okay, let's say we got to spend the money. My definition of success from this program would be the person's out of homelessness. It's not enough to me, for me to say it's a success if we just clear a camp. Because like that's good. It'll fix the problem temporarily. They'll probably move back in. A big chunk of them just go somewhere else. You haven't really fixed the problem. You've just moved it around. So to me, a successful program and successful spending on any aspect of the homeless crisis is, are we getting someone to exit from the system where they no longer need the assistance of taxpayer dollars and where they're no longer homeless? So to me, I look at that figure of how many people has the right-of-way program actually succeeded in getting out of homelessness? The number is 126. And so that would account for 1,137,256 per person. That's unacceptable. There's some weird noise outside. You hear that?
Yeah.
Do you guys hear that too? We don't know what that is. Sorry. So that to me is absolutely egregious. It's absolutely unacceptable. And it shows that the governor doesn't deserve another dime. All right, coming up next, we have an opportunity for you tomorrow to get gas prices at the national average per gallon. Very excited about this. But first, we've been talking about our friend Wes Jones, a wonderful real estate agent in our area. He and his team have things they can offer you if you're selling your home that you're not going to find anywhere else, like the Listing Boost concierge service. What that does is if you got to sell your home, you're like, I know that if I make some updates, I can get more money from it, but I don't have the time to undertake all of that. I don't have the money to do it. His team can help do it for you. That's what they did for Susan in Federal Way, who sold her house after living there for 25 years.
I knew I had to paint. I knew I needed to get new flooring. I needed to get new lighting. I told him up front that I was very interested, that I did not have the time or the finances to do what needed to be done. And he immediately jumped in with, well, I do. Work started immediately. And I would say in 2 to 3 weeks, they had landscaping done. They had all the painting done. The new floors were put in. All the lighting was put in. It just was all so fast. And the rest is history. It was on the market for 7 days. I was able to get well over listing price.
To be specific, Susan got 20 offers, sold it for 15% over list price, and ended up getting $200,000 more than an investor offered her before the renovations. Yeah, and that's awesome. That's just with one call to Wes Jones. And she had called other real estate agents, never called her back. She called Wes Jones, he picked up, and then she got $200,000 more than she would have otherwise gotten. So that's an absolute win. So check out sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. You can start by simply using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, I got something for you guys today. So you know I'm an ambassador for Future 42. They're a wonderful supporter of our show, and it's really an entity dedicated to trying to do the things that we're trying to do on the show. Give common sense a comeback, bring balance back to Washington State, and just to make sure that our policies are sound, and they're not based on, you know, fringe ideologies. And gas prices is a big one, and what's happening with the carbon tax is a big one. And this lack of acknowledgement from the governor that this program is really hurting, you know, low-income and working-class people the most. We're looking at, you know, up to 50 cents a gallon now that it's going to have the impact to you that that program is going to have. So tomorrow, from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., there is going to be an opportunity to purchase gas at the national average level. And in fact, let's check in on what are the prices right now. So national average is like $3.80. Washington still has one of the highest gas prices in the country. Wonderful. Anyway, thank you, AAA. I always get depressed when I look at the AAA map because it's like red, solid red on the West Coast. But anyway, so coming up tomorrow, and Nicole, if you want to put up this little graphic with some information. So Future 42 and Americans for Prosperity are going to be holding an event at Jackson's Shell Station in Kent tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. That's at 22588 84th Avenue South in Kent. And I'll post this to my social media pages as well. And from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., if you show up, you can fill up your tank for $3.89 a gallon. Now, of course, they want you to come there and they want people to be aware and to be able to tell people about why this is happening, because they're going to see that the gas station sign and be like, wow, that's low. And then they can get a little more information about the impact of the carbon program. And they can also, by the way, they have a chance to sign an initiative to do away with the carbon program, which I think is a good opportunity. But we asked Simon Sefcik, a former state lawmaker who is a director for Future 42, to come on the show and to tell us about what they're doing and why they're doing it. Simon Sefcik, welcome back to Undivided.
Brandy, thanks for having me.
Now, I couldn't help but notice that you guys are having this event tomorrow during my show. Is that intentionally so I can't come take advantage of the gas prices?
Well, you know, Brandy, the goal is to make sure that you can't come down and take advantage of it, but that all of your listeners can listen to your show and enjoy the line while they're getting cheaper gas.
Gotcha.
So it's just specifically targeted to punish you.
Yeah, I know. I figured. So this is kind of obviously to show Washingtonians how good they could have it if our elected leaders actually cared about their budget and their pocketbook. But first, who's paying for this? Somebody's got to pay for this, right?
Yes, that's correct. There's no such thing as a free lunch, as the old saying goes. So yes, this is being covered by Americans for Prosperity, which is a national organization, to essentially illustrate exactly what you said, which is that while oil is a global commodity, the specific price hikes we've seen this year are exactly because of the carbon trade program that the governor and the majority party have supported.
Yeah. So if folks come and our viewers and listeners come and they want to take advantage of the lower gas prices, what is are they going to be given a message when they get there? What is that going to look like for them?
Yeah. Well, you know, Brandy, we're anticipating there being a good amount of people. So the idea is to get there earlier so you don't have to wait as long in line. But yeah, there's going to be an opportunity for people to learn about the taxes that exist in Washington state that are causing these increases, and also an opportunity for people to sign a petition in order to have the carbon tax program removed, to say, if you want this vision to become a reality in the state, we can make that happen. But it's not going to happen if we just sit by and close our eyes and cross our fingers and wish that that were the case. It's going to take action. And this provides people a real opportunity to engage in that type of action.
Well, and one of the reasons I like it is it's very visual, right? It's everybody wants lower gas prices. So you see it. Are you getting the marquee changed, by the way?
What's the marquee?
Well, you know, the little, the board.
Yes. Yeah, correct. It'll be lower, you know, for people to see that and understand, you know, when they drive by that prices will be cheaper. And yeah, I mean, I think it's a great visual illustration when people are seeing the other competing gas stations nearby. Or, you know, it's always just funny whenever people talk about people going on summer vacations this year, the other states they've been to realize that prices don't have to be this way. And this is not normal in the United States of America to have prices this high.
Yeah. And what I was saying is, you know, it's a visual thing for people to be like, oh, wow, that's different. But how, and then to be, you know, told, hey, here's what's going on. Here's what this is doing to gas prices in Washington state specifically. How aware do you think the general public is about the direct impact the governor's carbon program is having at the pump?
You know, I think it obviously always depends on exactly what the sources are that people are listening to. But I think the average person does understand that there's been a new tax that's been implemented that's been part of these increases. But Brandy, as I think you've pointed out on your show before, there's obviously a little bit of doublespeak, because on the one hand, the majority party tells you that this is all because of those evil, greedy oil companies that have just chosen to jack up the price of oil uniquely in Washington state by a very specific number. And then there's the other people that will straight up tell you that this is the goal of the program, that the goal of the program was to increase prices in order to force people off of gas-powered vehicles. One of those things can be true. Both of those things could be false, but both of those things most certainly cannot be true.
Yeah, it's a good point. And you have to look back, as you said, to what is the intent, right? What is it designed to do? And this, in my opinion, and I don't think it's a stretch at all, is the natural reaction, is the natural reaction of the market to what that program was intended to do. Simon, so explain for folks just the nuts and bolts of how tomorrow is going to work, timing and all of that.
Certainly, yeah. So if anybody's near Kent, Washington tomorrow, from 10 to 12 o'clock, there's going to be the Jackson's Shell Station, which is just right off Highway 167. People have the opportunity to pull in from that time, and they can get a gallon of gas for about $3.82, which is the amount the gas should cost in the state were not for the gas tax and the carbon trade tax. And so it's an opportunity for people to come to see the type of world that we should or could live in were it not for some of these programs, and to enjoy hopefully some relief at the pump.
Yeah, and they them getting the cheaper gas does not mean they have to sign the initiative, correct?
That's right. Yes, you can come and simply enjoy the cheaper prices. And if you'd like, you know, learn more about what we're trying to do to reduce gas prices for everybody, not just for one day, not just for a certain time in a time period, but hopefully permanently in this state, to give people the relief that they need.
All right, Simon Sefcik, I love it. Director for Future 42. We appreciate your time, and I guess enjoy the gas prices that I won't be able to take advantage of, but I hope that some of our viewers and our listeners do.
I hope so too, Brandy. Take care.
Yeah, here we are doing show prep tomorrow. Could be in Kent getting $3.89 a gallon gasoline. Now, I do want to note, you can fill up your tank for $3.89. However, you can't bring, what do you call them, gas thingies?
Cans, gas cans.
Gosh, wow. You can't bring gas cans, any external buckets.
And it's per gallon. I mean, I know you were correcting him, but it's also per gallon. You said you can fill up your tank for $3.80, whatever.
Per gallon, yes.
But
yeah.
Gallon.
Per
gallon.
Okay, come
just
on.
Being
yes. Per gallon. Jackson's Shell Station on 84th Avenue South in Kent tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. So get there early so you can get out in time to, you know, tune in to the Undivided podcast. But I think that's great. See, this is why I'm an ambassador for Future 42. Love this. Love it. Best shtick ever. Okay, let's step outside of Washington State momentarily. There was this video I saw going around. I'm like, gosh. And then there was an exchange about it. I'm like, we got to talk about this ridiculousness. So the mayor of Burbank posted a video. And I think this is like what's interesting is like he sees no problem with this. And I'm just sort of like, why? And then Libs of TikTok shared it. And that's when it was really like, oh, this is now a culture war thing. He is being spanked with a paddle by a drag queen. Let's see. Yeah, there it is. There was some colorful music, but I didn't want a copyright strike, and so I took it off. Just, what is that, three spanks? And like, the drag queen was really going for it.
Well, I think that's the video repeat. Spank. I don't know how
many. Oh, wait,
actually
it
did.
Wasn't three spanks? Wait, play it again.
Okay.
Play it again. Oh, okay. It was one spank and then a tap, a little pat. One spank and a little pat on the butt. Why?
Birthday spanking. Yeah, but I don't know.
Why? Why? I just don't understand. I don't understand. And I like fun. I like to have fun. But you clearly knew that this was going to be picked up. It was going to become a thing, and you don't have anything better to be doing or posting about as mayor. But anyway, I thought it was, what I thought was interesting is not like, okay, he got spanked with a paddle. Do what you want to do. If you want to do that in private, by the way, do it in private. No one's going to judge you. Do what you want to do, but I just don't know that you need to post it. But why I was more interested in talking about it today is I think it goes to this grander, you know, culture wars thing, but I think a really legitimate conversation that we need to actually elevate past the culture war level about, you know, what we're exposing kids to. Because Libs of TikTok posted about this. And then this, and I don't think.
It's the drag queen posted this. So I'll show you the graphic.
Okay.
Yes. So on the left is the advertisement for it.
For and it. Then, like, this is the event.
Right. And I just, we made that bigger so you could read it. And then on the right is the back and forth between Libs of TikTok and the mayor.
Yeah. So the mayor said, actually, there weren't any children at this private 21 plus event. But of course, lying is totally on brand for you. And then Libs of TikTok shares the flyer and says, actually, the advertisement says 15 plus, which it does. So, yeah, I love that the mayor's accusing them of lying, saying it was a private 21 plus event. Mm-hmm. But on the flyer, it says ages 15 and over, event not suitable for children. Why are you inviting
Maybe
children?
Maybe they should have said not suitable for toddlers.
Right. Like, why are you inviting children then? So I love it that Libs of TikTok is like, actually, this is the event that the drag queen posted and said it's 15 plus. And so they said, the drag queen who performed posted about the event on Instagram and noted that it was open for ages 15 plus, but also said it's not suitable for children. So the drag show where the mayor got spanked was open for minors while they acknowledged it wasn't suitable for children.
Right.
Make it make sense. And then, of course, the mayor, having been, you know, confronted with the obvious lie he told about it being 21 plus, said, regardless of advertising, there were no children at the event, but you weren't there, so you wouldn't know. Easier to speculate and lie, right? So he's clearly on the defensive, but it was an event that said for 15 plus. Now, if there weren't children there, fine, but that is what they advertised the event for. But that is what really, of all of this, the back and forth, the video itself, I don't care what adults do in their free time, I don't care what adults do in private, although this video was obviously made public. The thing that really gets me with this drag queen's advertisement, where, can you put that back up, Nicole?
Mm-hmm.
Where the drag queen has her tatas out, you know, really, really putting them out there. Ages 15 and over, event not suitable for children. I can tell you, looking at that flyer, I know the event isn't suitable for children. But are we now classifying 16, 17-year-olds as adults? Because are we going to change the age? So that's what really gets me, is like they're trying to make this sort of thing acceptable for teenagers. And we've seen that sort of filtered through a lot of the culture war things related to the LGBTQ community, related to the debate over drag queen story time, etc. I've told you before, if it's a drag queen dressed as an old lady, it's like kind of a cute old like gimmicky thing where it's a costume, fine. But if it's a drag queen like this with her tatas out for everyone to see, like, no, that's not someone who I want performing for children or children tipping them with money. So anyway.
I also think it's just bad judgment, right?
So it you is have a bad very
high profile job, and it's just bad judgment to be posting about this, to be allowing video cameras, like, do what you want in your free time. But when you are a public figure that is supposed to be making decisions for children in your community, yes, for everyone in your community, like, just use better judgment. And that's what this is exposing.
Yeah. Our friend Mario Lotmore with the Lynwood Times, make sure you support the Lynwood Times if you haven't already, because they're one of the common sense news publications in the area exposing some of the ridiculousness. He has a good point. I'm going to give you a little benefit of the doubt. He says 8 is above 5 on the keypad. Is it? I don't have one.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He says maybe it's a typo. It's giving them a lot of benefit of the doubt. But he's saying 8 is above the 5. So maybe it's a typo.
Well, that has not been a claim yet.
Wait a second. Hold on. Somebody just told me something else I need to look at.
Uh-oh.
Go to that. Hold on. Pull it back up, Nicole.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have the original graphic? Somebody said that if you look at the upper right, Beth says the drag queen event was sponsored by the Democratic Party. See upper left of advertisement.
Oh, yeah. It says Santa Clara Valley Dems present.
Oh. Okay. I didn't even see that. Okay. All right. Now I like the story even more. Wow. You guys are good. I didn't even see that. Thanks, Beth. Good times. Okay. All right. Before we get to questions and comments from the live stream, I've been talking about my success on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan. I now have multiple friends who are on the program, which is awesome because we just sit and text each other. And it's great to do it in a group where you're supported. I've talked to couples who watch the show who have done it, had fantastic results. So if you've been hearing me do these ads since January, and maybe like during the summer, you're like, I'm not starting a new program in the summer. I get that. It's not summer anymore for much longer. 11 days. And then you have no more excuses. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. I'll tell you, if you start the program now, you can get in great shape by the holidays. Because remember, I started beginning of November last year. I lost almost 30 pounds by the end of the year. So you really, if you follow the program, can get really fantastic results. No prepackaged meals, no counting calories. It's teaching you how to eat the right foods in the right portions and how to maintain that weight loss for life. So EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. You can schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team to make sure the program is right for you before you commit. All right. Okay, let's get to comments. Holy moly, we got a lot of comments today. I'll get to as many as I can. Like usual, I'm running late on the show. We might as well just make the show 5 hours long. Nicole's like,
nah.
All right. On the SPD video, Mugshot Espresso says, SPD, we should be given more respect by the council. Also SPD, this video. Just when the activists needed more fuel and boom, they are given it. And part of that, I think, is by design. This, you look at all the dash cam video, all the body-worn camera video that was part of that investigation. Someone tipped someone off to the existence of this 2 minutes, obviously, because it hadn't been released yet. SPD hadn't made it public. It was already out being discussed. There were reporters working on stories about it. And so I think this was, you know, they just ended the majority of the consent decree. And so, yeah, there's a reason why someone tipped, and I'm not saying they shouldn't have. Yeah, the video is newsworthy, but there's a reason why all the body-worn footage, this is the one the media was requesting. This is the one the media knew about. But yeah, I agree. I mean, it's just like what SPD doesn't need are unforced errors. And this is a ridiculous unforced error, regardless of what the context of the conversation was. Casey Leonard said, what he said was inexcusable. If there wasn't such a drug epidemic, the officer may not have been running code to save an addict. Also true. This proves how the open drug use in Seattle snowballed into other citizen safety. Such a good point. Such a good point is that you really have that crisis affecting so many aspects of our life that we might not even realize. And this is a rule. Severe example, but these examples exist. And you have drug addicts who, as a result, have mental health issues, who commit horrible, violent acts, who kill people. And it's just awful. Rick Johnson said, I'm very pro-law enforcement, but there's nothing remotely funny about that young girl being killed. If the cop was doing 74 on a downtown street posted 25, that's insane. Zero room for error. Could have been any of us. Harold Burns says, having been a first responder some years back, developing calluses on your soul is a defense mechanism. This is dark humor, but doesn't cross the line because it was supposed to be a private convo. Okay.
I will say, I see how they get desensitized, especially yes. In Seattle when they're dealing with that a lot. And I'm going to go with they're talking about lawyers and how lawyers kind of, look for making money in situations mm-hmm. like that. So if they're on that conversation, but when he says, no, it's a regular person, I can see where they're desensitized to the drug addicts, the homelessness, and these calls are every day, all day, right? And so I see the desensitization given the atmosphere that they're working in right now. But it doesn't make it okay. It
doesn't make it okay, and it's an unforced error.
I see where they build up these calluses because it would be a really depressing job.
Oh, 100%.
Really 100%. Terrible. 100%. Yeah. If you didn't, try to find ways to deal with it.
Yeah. Mandy said, we all have public versus private self. The convo was obviously meant to be private. The jesting is an emotional response to placing value on human life and how the city and their insurance will do that. And I guess that's what the officer's argument is. I don't know that because I can't hear the other side of the phone call. I'm not willing to take this officer's word that that's what the conversation was about. It's not because I think he's a liar. I don't know him, but that's just my job is I'm not going to fill in blanks where I'm incapable of filling in the blanks because I haven't heard the other part of the conversation.
And we did reach out to Solon for comment.
We did.
We haven't heard back.
Yeah. Okay. On Bob Ferguson saying that he is sticking up for victims of violent crime. Charlie says, Ferguson's silence equals acceptance of the status quo, which is unacceptable. I agree. Overall, in many ways, we are all less safe. I don't know how anyone could dispute that we're less safe than they were when we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Inslee saying he needs more money to clear these right-of-way encampments. Matthew Cook says, the problem with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money. Margaret Thatcher. Love it. On gas price opportunity tomorrow, which again, I'll post more information on social media. Mike Whitman says, I work in the oil industry, and if you all knew how many taxes Washington collects, you'd be beyond shocked. The first tax is a $45,000 spill tax imposed the second a tanker enters Washington waters. Yeah, I'm sure there are a ton of just bringing up the money. Let me see. GTBD00. Which you need a new screen name. You know how hard that is for me to say?
I know.
$4.99 super chat. And it's funny because Nicole can't put when it's a GIF or something in the show sheet for me to see. So I just see her typing it out, a description. It's a fox saying, hiya. I like it. Okay. Thank you, Nicole. It's a fox saying, hiya. All right. Good questions and comments today. Okay. Because I was so rudely interrupted by some foreign noise. Let me revisit a point I was making earlier on in our closing sanity check, shall we? Look, I realize that the state of Washington has got itself into a situation around homelessness that it is going to take money to dig ourselves out of. I get that. It's not going to happen magically. It's not going to happen overnight. It's very complex. I do understand it's going to take money. But as I've said previously, we need to make sure that we are putting money toward things that are proven to produce results. And we need to make sure that every single cent of that money is being accounted for, because the homeless industrial complex isn't it. The homeless industrial complex needs to be dismantled. And the story we talked about earlier is the definition of the homeless industrial complex. Governor Jay Inslee, in response to a lot of criticism of homeless encampments that were sometimes within the limits of a city, but completely out of their control because they're on state property, WashDOT property, he starts this right-of-way initiative. He's like, it's talking about how, oh, we're going to get these encampments cleared. $143 million later, what do we have to show for it? $143 million later, and the governor is now saying, well, we need more money to be able to deal with that. Again, I would just revisit, okay, if you're looking at what is the success of that program so far, how do we measure success? I'm giving you three different figures to consider depending on what you view as a successful program. Do you view it as you cleared somebody out of a homeless encampment? Well, in that case, they've cleared 1,299 people out of homeless encampments for a cost of $143 million. That's $110,000 per person to tell them to get out of here. If you view success as, okay, it's got to be more than just clearing the person away, we need to make sure that they're in housing. Temporary housing, permanent supportive housing. If that's your measure of success, then we're looking at $164,000 per person. Only 870 people have accepted offers of housing through this program. And if you're like me and you have a higher expectation of what it means to actually see success out of this program and out of the millions of dollars in tax money that's being spent on it, 126 people, because of this program, made exits from homelessness, made exits from the homeless industrial complex. And if you do the math, at $143 million spent, that is $1,137,256 per person to get them an exit from homelessness. That is a figure and an outcome that is only acceptable when it's the government spending your money. It would be insanity to give Governor Jay Inslee more money to carry out a failed program. Put the money in the hands of the private sector. Make sure that every single dollar is accounted for. You have people like Andrea Suarez with We Heart Seattle. Can you imagine what she could do with $143 million and the power and the authority and the ability granted to her by cities and counties in the state to go in and clear encampments? She's doing it already, and she's doing it for a fraction of that. Only the government would spend more than $1 million per person to get them out of homelessness. It's insane, and we cannot allow it to continue. It's not in the best interest of taxpayers, and it's not in the best interest of the people who are suffering on our streets. All right, that has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Make sure to check out our merch store. We're going to get out some of our first orders soon. We're just, wow, I feel momentum. I was telling Nicole, I feel momentum. Feel like we're taking off. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com. Join our mission and our movement to give common sense a comeback, just $5 a month. And in fact, if you join, you get $5 off our merch store. So it's like net, it's even. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com. I'll see you guys back on the live show tomorrow at noon.